Job chapter 3 this morning. Job chapter 3. Wonderful singing today, and I praise the Lord for the truths of the songs we've sung, primarily the person of the song that we've sung today. Focus on Jesus. I think that's primarily what makes us Christians, isn't it? It's that we've got one message. We've got one man, and it was Jesus. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to lift his name up together with you today. And thank you so much for plugging in and pouring your heart into the singing today. Brother Harold, thank you for leading us in our worship this morning. Job chapter 3, the Bible says, "After this opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. And Job spake and said, let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let blackness of day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined into the day of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. Let them curse it that curse the day, who are ready to raise up their mourning." I think Job's kind of passionate about his birthday. In other words, he's saying, I wish I hadn't had a birthday. I wish there was no such day as July 15th. I wish there had been a July 14th and a July 16th. I wish the night had seized a hold of the other night, and I wish that it brought them two together and they skipped the 15th. I wish that's what had happened. I wish that anything that went on the day I was born, in fact, he'll go so far as you read here, I wish my mother had never rejoiced. I wish my family had never sent celebration. I wish that no one had ever known what it was to have me in their life. Let the stars, the twilight thereof, be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me? Or why did the breast that I should suck? For now, should I have lain still and be quiet? I should have slept. It means died. Then had I been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth, which build desolate places for themselves, or with princes that have gold, who filled their houses with silver, or had an hidden, untimely birth. I had not been as infants which never saw light. There the wicked cease from troubling, and their weary be at rest. There the prisoners rest together, and hear not the voice of the oppressor. The small and great are there, and the servant is free from his master. Boy, he's making death sound like a pretty inviting place, isn't he? There are no servants, there's no slaves in death. Nobody's ever separated, they're all together when they're dead. Wherefore is light given unto him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul, which long for death, but it cometh not, and dig for it more than for hid treasure, which rejoice exceeding, and are glad when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid, and whom God hath hedged in? For my sighing cometh before I eat, and my roarings are pouring out like the waters. For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came." The book of Job fits in a series of five books all together, known as the books of wisdom. The books of wisdom were designed, were built, or at least they serve the purpose of giving us a picture of God. That's what they were built for. That's why we have them, is to reflect on the person of God. As you can imagine, the English language would be short in trying to describe the full glory of God. Actually, not just the English language, our ability to think is not capable of taking in the person of God. To understand who he is, there's not language enough. If you put all the languages of the world together, we could not describe God. If you then could put all the languages together and you could master all of the languages so that you could rightly describe God, it would be outside of the ability of our mind to retain God. And so the writers of the Book of Wisdom were giving us reflections. They were giving us understanding about who God is. He was pushing against the simple views of God. God is complex. He's meant to be. We are simple compared to him. And these five books of wisdom teach us the nature of God. Consider the book of Psalms, a beloved passages that are written in Psalms. So many of them tell us what God was thinking or why he did what he did. In fact, many of the Psalms are questions to God. God, why did you leave me? Or God, why did you do this? Or God, why did you make me feel this way? God, why do I do this when everybody else is doing something else? But the book of Psalms was never a reflection on how man feels. It was always a reflection about how man feels about God. If you look through the book of Psalms, you begin to unearth truths that you and I take for granted that in the first centuries they would have been reading and saying, my goodness, that's what God's like. That's why when I pray this happens. They were hearing this for the first time and they were beginning to understand God is not just this person that sits out there and is being mean to me, or God is not just this person who coldly sits out there and lets things happen, but that God is as the Bible describes him. So the book of Psalms is trying to describe God and giving us the ability to understand. As God would reveal himself to the writer, he would bring and allow the writer and through inspiration would pin these songs together. And as they would sing about the greatness and the marvelous nature of God. And they would sing about God. And in their songs, they are learning the nature of God. The book of Song of Solomon, one that probably you read to your children every night before bed. No, it's an awkward book. It's an uncomfortable book. We don't even do it in mixed groups in conservative churches, right? It's an awkward book, but the whole book is really about God. The whole book is describing the relationship between the nation of Israel and this mystery of God that they can't get enough of each other. It should be, the way God designed it, was that they would be like lovers who I know you today, but I want to be with you tomorrow. And I know, we got to spend time together today, but I want to see you tomorrow, and can I see you then? And what will it be like later? And what about when we grow, and as we grow, and as we get to know each other? And the whole book is written from this dimension of two lovers who are looking into their future together. And that's what God is doing with man. He is allowing us to understand that today isn't all there is. What about tomorrow? What about what happens when you get to know me? And what about what happens when you open yourself to me? And we get to understand each other. You see, it was a picture of God. We were to know more about God through this book of wisdom. The book of Proverbs paints the picture of God who is like a man with a balance in his hand, a scale in his hand. If you have wisdom, he'll place wisdom on this side. He'll put you on this side, and the scale will measure whether or not you are wise. Wisdom has certain fruit, certain consequences that we would expect. If you're a wise man, then wise things will happen. If you're a foolish man, you will meet destruction. And this is verse after verse after verse after verse after verse, all the way through the book of Proverbs. What is Solomon doing? He is balancing the nature of godliness. If you are wise, God allows this to happen. If you are foolish, God allows this to happen. And these are the kind of meter of God. Now, by the way, just in case you think so simplistic of Solomon, he then writes another book called the Book of Ecclesiastes, in which he takes everything we talk about in the book of Proverbs, crunches it up and throws it away. Because then he says, by the way, even if you're wise and even if you're foolish, you get to the end of it and you die. And it's all vanity. It's all vanity. There's nothing fair. There's no such thing as justice. And that's really the heart of the whole book of wisdom. It's a book of Proverbs. You have this, man, God is just, and he has this specific way of dealing with you. And if you do good, good happens. If you do bad, bad happens. And it's this very cut and dry book. And boy, we love that. Book of Ecclesiastes, not so comfortable. Because you might live good and still face bad things. And you might be awful and still end up rich. And at the end of it all, you both die. You get to the end, as my mom used to say. I would complain about something. And she goes, I know, life is so hard. And at the end, you die. Isn't it bad? That was her mocking me. Like, I had real problems in my life. The struggle was real. And here she is mocking me. And that's the truth. We go through hardship. And at the end, guess what? We all stop breathing. That's the finality. Solomon steps back from that. He goes, so basically the measure of everything is it's all vain. It's all vexation of spirit. You can try as hard as you want. I can't figure it out. And Solomon was allowing us to understand that there's a complexity to God. There is space to understand that maybe us trying to approach God with this and that, this and that, this and that, maybe that's not right. And frankly, much of Christianity today is built around that idea that if you do this, then this happens. If you do this, then this happens. If you do this, then this happens. And we make no room for the book of Ecclesiastes where Solomon says, hey, you can do all the right things and still die at the end. And still have nothing. You still be perfect and still be judged a fool. Boy, we don't like that picture of God. We like it when God does what we expect. When what I invested is exactly what I get back out. We're uncomfortable with this other book, the book of Job. You see, the book of Job is the physical manifestation. Though it happened before, I believe it may have been the precursor to understanding what Solomon was trying to force into our heads. What happens when you approach life like Job? Good man, but bad things happen. A good man when everything fell apart. You see, Job is the physical manifestation of the fight between Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. It's what happens when you take Proverbs to its fullest extent and you refuse to allow place for Ecclesiastes. When you decide, no, the only way God can be right is if good, you get good. If bad, you get bad. That's the only way God can be God. And if you run that out to its fullest degree, what will it look like? It will look like a man who's come to the end of himself only to be argued with by three other parts. And over the next couple of chapters, which you actually find, starting in chapter 3, and we'll go on for the next 39 chapters. We're not going chapter by chapter, don't worry. But going throughout the rest of the book is really a conversation between four men, and then a fifth one will appear, between four men who are wrestling out how God can be God even if it didn't turn out the way they expected. I believe then at the close of the book, we find God step in. God never answers the questions. We would have liked to have had some answers to Satan's question last week. We would have liked to have some answers to man's question last week. But God really is only intent on answering one question. And as we look at this passage, we can begin to see the breakdown of Job. Last week we saw a man, we remember the story opened with the accuser going before God, and he points at Job, and as God says, have you considered my servant Job? Job looks at God and says, no, this man Job only serves you because you bless him. The accuser doing his job very well. Job then stripped of all earthly possessions, including his own children, taken and torn from his own hands. This is called the first trial. His kids died in the first trial. His fam, everything was torn from him. And that was trial number one. Trial number two comes later. In trial number two, we find in verse number 7 and 8 that Job's whole body is racked with disease. He has sores from the top of his head, from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet. In fact, the book that someone has put together and cataloged, it wasn't me, but a preacher cataloged all of the things that had gone on that he describes throughout the book. Consider this. In chapter 6 and verse number 4, Job talks about some other things he was going through. Number one, in Job 6:4 was feelings of terror. He was constantly being berated by a terror that lived with him constantly. In chapter 7 and verse 4 and 14, he had sleeplessness and could not sleep because of the nightmares. In chapter 7 and verse number 5, he suffered from ulcers. In chapter 30, verse 17, he describes his bones rotting. In chapter 30, verse 30, his skin was growing black and actually falling off of his own body. In chapter 16, verse 16, his vision was failing. In chapter 19, verse 20, he saw that his own teeth were rotting out of his head. In chapter 19, verse 17, of course, this led to a constant case of halitosis, or bad breath. He was falling apart. This was not a man who, like we describe in Sunday school, well, he had some acne, he had some bumps and bruises, and it wasn't real. No, the guy was literally coming apart at the seams. Physically, his body was nothing. Hear me. His body for the rest of his life, even when God brings everything back to Job, he will always bear the pit marks. He'll always bear the scars. He'll always have soreness. He'll always suffer from this. It doesn't clean up at the end of the book. He doesn't walk away from this without scars. He'll always have this. He is attacked physically. His own body is not held away from the destruction that the accuser wishes to bring. And in chapter number 1, verse 21, he closes out the chapter this way. When speaking about all of his loss under test number 1, he says, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb. Naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Wow. We kind of marvel at that. In chapter 2, he does the same thing. Remind you that it's in chapter 2 that we find his wife coming to him with the great wisdom. "Won't you just curse God and die?" Now, that sounds harsh, right? Like, don't use that at lunch. Okay, like that's pretty stark conversation to have with someone. "I wish you would just curse God and die." That's kind of how we imagine it being said. I don't know the motivation. I don't know the motivation that was said. Maybe she was being used by Satan. Some have said, well, she was clearly being used by the devil at this point. But the Bible's pretty good in Job to tell us what is Satan's doing and what is not Satan's doing. And we never find Satan working here. It's just the wife responding to her husband. So I don't know that it was Satan who came and did this. I don't know if she was speaking necessarily with gritted teeth of hatred to her husband. Maybe she was hurt. And maybe she was hurt. She lost her children too. But maybe as a wife, she was sharing the view of the day. That if, you know, maybe you did sin. And since you've sinned, God's not really happy with you. And so it's probably likely that she shared the view that Job shared of God. And that was, if you were good, the good things would be happening. If you're bad, then bad things are happening, so you must be bad. And then there's the fourth one, which I actually kind of believe could be most likely it, and that was she was kind of trying to have mercy for him. I mean, even she could look at the pain he was constantly in, and maybe she just said, "Job, if God is working against you, if you've upset God, at least if you cursed him, it would end. At least if you cursed him, it could be over. Job, don't keep trying. I know you're trying to be strong for me, but Job, if this thing could end and you could not have to go through this anymore, why don't you just end it? Why don't you just curse him and he'll end this thing?" Maybe that was it. I don't know her motivation. I do know what she says though, right? And we do know Job's response. And I think Job gives us an idea in verse number 10. "But he said unto her, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh." So even Job wasn't willing to call her wicked. Even Job didn't think the motivation was sinful in any way. Job saw it as foolishness, right? To him, it was, no, that's just foolish. I don't think you really understand what you're saying here. And so even Job wasn't willing to call her out on sin. And then he teaches her. He says, "What, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil?" Verse number 2:10 says, "In all this did not Job sin with his lips." It's amazing to me. He's going through all of this trouble, all of this problem, all of this circumstance is crushing down on him. And then chapter 3 starts. Now, the point of chapter 3, all the way up until chapter 3, Job didn't sin. You find it in the verse number 1:22, "And all this Job sinned not and nor charged God foolishly. In chapter 2, verse 10, in all this did not Job sin. That's pretty awesome. Way to go. You made it two whole chapters. I would have been busted by verse 2. And here he is, two chapters in, and he hasn't sinned against God. That's amazing. And then chapter 3. You see, now chapter 2 closes out with a conversation between Job and his wife. Curse God, die. No thanks. Then three friends show up and stay with him 7 days and 7 nights. Now they do what is customary. They do the customary thing. They come in, they sit down. He's wearing ashes and has torn his clothing. They sit down with him. They put the ashes on their head and they tear their own clothing. And they sit there. For 7 days and 7 nights, they do not say a word. They sit there. We're going to talk about these men in the weeks ahead, but suffice it to say, maybe there's wisdom in not having to have an answer. They just sit there. It's after the 7 days, Job has received counsel from one person, and that was Job. Job took counsel with his own heart. By the way, be careful. Your heart can be a pretty wicked counselor. Because in chapter 3, everything changes. After 7 days and 7 nights, with his own heart as his comfort, with his own heart as his counselor, Job emerges a different man, a different tone. He has pondered his understanding of God now. I think it's a reminder what Jesus said to his disciples when he told them, it is not what enters a man that defiles him, it's what comes out of the man that defiles a man. It's a reminder to us that input is one thing, it's what we do as a response. Job has dug as far as his feeble understanding of God will let him go. He is not fully there. We are chapters from his full revelation as to how far his view of God would take him. But his view of God, if you would consider this the first step in evolution, it's called despair. When we try to force God, when we attempt to control in this life, everything about this life, it leads the soul to despair. You see, what Job has done is he has taken his view of God, that Proverbs view, good equals good, bad equals bad, and he is allowing it to grow in his heart to the fullest degree possible. He has made no room for the book of Ecclesiastes that maybe, just maybe, God's plan is bigger than our own. And even at the end, it's still vanity. He's made no room for that. And so he is exploding this view farther and farther and farther out. And we're catching him early on in chapter 3. And it is leaving Job with this idea, an idea that we're going to watch argued out over the next couple of chapters. But it leaves us with this idea, either God allows good things to happen to bad, good people, and therefore I am not a good person, or God is not a good God. And he is wrestling out in his mind which is true. Now, to this point, Job has been sinless, right? We see it here. If anybody's considered good, even God described him in chapter 1 as upright and perfect. He's good. He's a good guy. And so even Job looks at his own life. He says, wait a second. Either I'm not a good guy, and I am, or he's not a good God. So let's hear it. Let's find out, is he really a good God? Let's understand who you really are. Let's get to it, because either one of two things is true. Either I am not a good man, or you are not a good God. And he begins to wrestle this out. Now watch, all of this is happening from one point of view. All of this is happening from this basic point of, we'd even call it the simplistic view of God. That either good equals good, bad equals bad, or God cannot be good. And it has now grown to its fullest extent. And in its first stages is what I call despair. Despair when we find out we do not get to control God. Despair is what happens when man does not get to control God. And every attempt to control your life leads the believer to despair. Consider this. Despair happens when God doesn't meet your expectations. Despair is what happens when God does not meet your expectations. Meaning that one person can go through trial and have no problems whatsoever, come out on the other side rejoicing and happy and grateful. Hard? Yes, very hard. But somebody goes through the loss of someone dear in their life, and they come out on the other side with joy. And then you take somebody who goes through the exact same loss, they come out on the other side further from God. What was the difference? Well, the difference is found somewhere in between here, in our understanding of God. Despair is that which is personal to us. In other words, you may go through an event in your life and come out without despair. I go through the same event in my life and I come out broken apart. What is this? It is the willingness of the individual, the participant, to try to control the experience, to control the environment, to control the circumstances. And to the greatest degree, or to the degree in which we are willing to try to control, we will find ourselves further in despair. I think that'll take some proving. I want you to see with me that this once patient and faithful man has now begun to sink into despair. It's something that is common for us today, in our culture today. There are believers who throw around the word depression as quickly as medical professionals. Well, they're facing depression. They have depression. He's depressed. I'm depressed. They're depressed. We all have depression. We're depressed. We're depressed. That's the kind of person we are. I'm just a depressed kind of person. And the issue is, the real question is it full depression or is it control allowed to run to its fullest extent? You see, Job is working out of his mind, if I am good and bad happens, then either I am not as good as I think I am, or God is the one that is bad. And so ultimately what is happening in front of us is not a man that is wrestling with the circumstance as much as he is he's wrestling with his understanding of God. It's been properly said that he did not come to this conclusion of chapter 3 because he was hurting. He was coming to the conclusion of chapter 3 because how can I live in a world where a God would allow hurt like this? Where at least if someone had it coming, I could live in a world where God punished those who had it coming. I can't live in a world where those who didn't have it coming still get punished. Many follow God as an insurance policy. They do good. They go to church. They read their Bible as a way to pay the premium so that they're all paid up. Because when trouble comes, they can call on God. And therefore, since the premiums are paid, God can come in and rescue them. Heaven help us if you haven't been paying your premiums. Because then the destruction is good and there's no God to help you through it. And we treat God as if he's some sort of big heavenly emergency program. We have a word for the trouble that we face when things don't go our way. That word is called stress. Stress is that juncture. Stress is the point where control slips from our fingers. Now, we wouldn't boldly say that we're trying to control God, but that's what happens with stress. The Christian becomes stressed because they've lost control. We wouldn't say, I'm trying to control God. I mean, we wouldn't be so bold as to say that. But truthfully, sometimes we do what we do so that God is inclined to do what we would expect. I mean, when our children don't do as we think they do or think they should, what happens? We get stressed out. They embarrass us in front of people at church. We go, stressed out. They don't respond the way we think they should respond. We get stressed out. But what is that? That's a recognition that I can't control this creature. I mean, I could probably make him stop breathing, but that's as far as my control could go. And we try to control, and every point we try to control, and we cannot control, we come across this emotion of stress. When your job stresses you out, it's a reminder that you do not have the control that you believed you did in that job. Well, everything at work was great until they took a job there, until so-and-so, until that person got a job here. Everything was perfect. And then you found out you can't control so-and-so. Isn't that right? Well, yeah, I wouldn't be so stressed out if it wasn't their fault. Or if you stopped trying to control them, you wouldn't be so stressed out. How about when your spouse is driving? No? Okay, never mind. We won't go there. Job is stressed out. Listen to his outrage. I mean, just hear it in his voice. Let the day perish wherein I was born. Let no joyful voice come therein. Why died I not from the womb? I probably don't need to tell you that the reason I am pro-life is because God is pro-life. God's against murder, y'all. I don't know if you know that. But he's against murder. And by the way, by proxy, abortion. He's pro-life because he's the one who created life. He's the one who gave life. And therefore, we're not trying to be pro-life because we're narrow-minded and don't want the world to have fun. We just believe God says what he says. And so we believe if God gave life, then he's the one who's the author of life. He's also the finisher of life. And so we don't believe it's okay to commit suicide. We don't believe it's okay to abort a life. We don't believe it's okay to commit murder. We don't believe it's okay to commit euthanasia. These are not narrow-minded conservative political views. These are Bible views. So when Job brings up, I wish I hadn't been born. I wish I had been stillborn. I wish I could go ahead and die. When he mentions these things, you recognize he's like skirting the rim of blasphemy. He's like edging right up to it. He's ultimately just saying, God, what kind of fool would let me come to this point in my life? What kind of merciless God wouldn't have killed me the day I was born so that I never had to face this? How can you be a good God and let me come all the way to this point? I at least could have understood if you had killed me at the womb and then told me, well, there's going to come some hard days, so I just saved you from it. Because a God should do what I expect him to do. Job has given way to allowing a moment of suffering to color the whole of his existence. And make no mistake, Job questioning the justice of a God that allows suffering, that's all that's happening here. He's questioning God. This comes from a heart that has decided God cannot be just and allow one to suffer. Okay? Now you'd say, well, shame on Job. Can I remind you? He made it two chapters without ever sinning against God. We get stuck in traffic and question God, right? Come on. Let's give the guy a break, but let's understand what journey he's in so maybe we can grow from it. We are tempted to do the same. When life doesn't meet our expectations, we find ourselves in pain or long-term hurt, and it's easy to begin to stress or to press against God. Job's not losing his faith. Job is not walking away from God. These are not what Job is doing. Job is pointing out how he cannot understand the God that he has loved for all these years. I do not have room in my head for the size of a God like this. I have room in my head for a God who does exactly what I expect him to do without fail, doing what I want and following the expected course. Good equals good, bad equals bad. And as long as I can know what to expect from God, I am happy to follow him. I don't know what to do with a God who does what he wants to do. Trusting God is not about ascribing to him all the nice things you think a good God would be. And then look for the moments in your life that support that he is a good God. Trust is the willingness to go through hell and know God is still in this with me. That's what trust is. Trust is not saying, God, you're good, so therefore no bad will come to me. No, 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 no. That's a bad view of God, according to Job. According to Job, God, you are a good God. And even if I can't understand it, and even if it scares the life out of me, and even if it means the loss of everything I hold dear, God, somehow I know you're good. This is trust. Trust is not building a God in your own mind. Trust is allowing that God is not to be controlled by your expectations. You see, despair happens when we attempt to control God and he does not meet our expectations. Understand, despair happens when we fall into deception. When we decide to hold on to that old view of God and refuse to let it go, you've become deceived. That is instant deception. No. I don't want room for a God who can choose and decide and still knows best even if it hurts me. I cannot handle that kind of God. Bing, 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 bing. You are deceived. You found it. That's the spot. Deception has entered in. You've allowed it. Deception is there. Understand with me in verse number 3, verse 23. Why is light given to man whose way is hid and whom God hath hedged in? Hear the wording there. God hedged me in. I think it's an important point of perspective. Look at chapter 1, verse 10. Just flip. Well, it's like one page. Come on, just flip over there real quick. Job chapter 1, verse 10. Now, these are the words of Satan to God. Okay? Hast thou not made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hand, and his substance is increased in the land. Satan said, I can't get to him because you have a hedge around him. Now, has anybody in here ever prayed a hedge of protection around someone? Anybody ever done that before? Yeah, we pray hedges all the time, right? Like in the spirit world, there's got to be littering of all the hedges that have been prayed by Christians everywhere. We have prayed for hedges. Now, by the way, it's comical to us that we would use this word hedge, right? Like we think of these bushes or whatever. But the reality is that when we pray that, we're actually just using actively the verse found here in chapter 1, verse 10. We get that from this passage. The old preachers that have prayed that for the last 40 years, hedge of protection about them, that guy got it from Job chapter 1, verse 10. Where Satan was saying, God, what you have done is you have built a wall around Job. I'd like to get to him. I'd like to have at him. I'd like to destroy him. I'd like to crush him. I'd like to bring him down. I'd like to crush him to powder. I'd like to watch him rue the day he was born, but you've protected him. Job in chapter 3 says, God, I'd like to be free from this thing. I'd like to be able to walk away from you, but you've hedged me in. You've built a wall I can't get around. You've built a wall that's trapped me. They're both looking at a hedge. From the inside, it looks like a trap, and on the outside, it looks like protection. The same stinking hedge. The same shield. The same guard. The same protection. The same barrier that God had put around Job seemed as a jail to Job, but to Satan it was protection. Can I tell you this morning how many of us have really prayed that God would protect us all the while, forgetting that maybe the protection was the very prison we were trying to get out of? Understand that Job begins to see death as the great relief of this hedge. I went out of this wall that you've put me in, and the only way to do it is to die. I mean, you heard it when we read it this morning, all the flowery ways he described death. It kind of reminds me of the way the Israelites described Egypt. Oh, we ate leeks and garlic, so we had so much oil, abundant oil, and here we are in the desert place. You're free. Like, you woke up this morning and no one told you to make bricks in an oven all day. You're free. Oh, I wish we could go back to Egypt. Job. Oh, I wish I didn't have all this God around me all the time. I wish he wasn't building these walls around me all the time. I wish he wasn't protecting me all the time. I wish he wasn't shielding me all the time. I wish I was free to do what I want to do. Oh, come on. We do the same thing, right? We do the same stinking garbage. We do. We do these things with small things, right? We do this with the stupid stuff we wear. We act like this towards God. Well, I wish I could be free to do whatever I want. I mean, I want my husband to be free from lust. I don't want him to have to be in bondage. But I want freedom to wear what I want to wear. Well, which way do you want it? Which way do you want it? Do you want your husband to have to lust every time a sister walks by and every time another believer comes to church, he's got to do this number so he can keep his eyes on God? Or do you want freedom? Which one do you want? Or do you want, you just show respect to every other husband in the building, and they'll all show respect to your husband, and you can all live in peace and enjoy one another's company? Which one do you want? Well, I want freedom. I need freedom. I need freedom. I just want freedom. I want to be able to go and come as I please. I don't want to have to feel like I need to be at church, and I don't want to feel like I have to be there every time the doors are open, and man, they're open a lot. What is with this guy? I want to be free. Yeah, but but your real role in life, I mean, your whole purpose in life isn't what's on Netflix. It's actually to grow towards the image of Christ. I mean, which one do you want? Do you want the freedom to go and do what you want and then hopefully get to heaven and somehow be glad that you caught up and you know, what? Lived like the world lived and did what the world did and checked all the boxes the world did, but you got in heaven? That's what you want? Which one do you want? We do that. We do that to God about everything. I want to be free. And we throw in music. Okay, well, which one do you want? Do you want to raise children who can't get their mind off of anything but the world, or do you want their mind on God just naturally? Do you want them to long for God? I mean, that's why he wrote the book of Psalms, for crying out loud, so the people would have a hunger for God. I think the kind of music you put in your home is going to change your home. But I mean, I really feel like I'm giving up something when I'm listening to these songs about a bunch of drunkards going out and having fun with their friends. No, alcohol actually being in your home is a pretty disgusting thing, and it's really dangerous to the life of your children. You might be able to find the boundary, but nobody's saying Junior can. I mean, let's be honest. We push against God all the time. We fight him on every single boundary, and we act as if God's trying to hedge us in. And God's saying, I'm building protections around your family. I'm building protections around your home. I'm building protections around your children. I'm building protections around your mind, and I'm putting these things here so your enemy can't get a hold of you. And your fight for liberty is breaking down the very thing I gave you to set you free. We fight him. We fight him on stupid stuff. Just find out what the Bible says and stink and live it. I mean, I'm not asking you to do anything hard. This isn't hard. Well, it's not what I signed up for. You didn't sign up. You crawled on your knees to a holy God who forgave you and set you free from sin. The same stinking sin that's trying to destroy your home. We didn't walk in here and say, well, God, you're getting a good deal. There's a contract. No, no contract. You had nothing. He had everything. He washed you clean. You're his now. Real simple. Quit pushing against the hedge. We live deceived as if somehow God lives for our existence. Job, this was the problem, buddy. You found yourself in despair because you believed God existed to protect you. God doesn't exist to protect you. God doesn't exist to make you happy. God doesn't exist to let you experience all the freedoms this life has to offer. You exist for God. And along the way, he's built provision to protect you. And the more you try to push him down, the more freedom starts to attack you. Job, wake up, buddy. You don't want to go down this path. Despair has brought Job so low. And there are Christians today, can I tell you, there are far more Christians today who are suffering the result of breaking down the protection God put in your home. And they're suffering the result. And we're trying to pick them up and encourage them because they are in despair for what they have gotten with the thinking that God somehow exists for them to have freedom and enjoy life. And on the other side, I'm working with Christians and I'm encouraging Christians saying, hey, there's nothing out there. Like, there's nothing out there. I mean, you can go do whatever you want. Oh, I'm free. Yeah, you're free. Go for it. Knock yourself out. And I'll help you pick up the pieces in 5 years. I just think maybe our approach to God has been really simplistic. And instead of approaching God as, God, I'm here to live for you, and I don't care what kind of trauma you take me through, I'm yours. I don't care if at the end of this life I don't get to experience any of the freedoms I thought I should have had. Lord, I'm yours. You see, he was brought to despair because he bought into deception that God existed for him. I keep the rules. God does this. I do this. God does this. I do this. God does this. No, broken, wrong, not the way it works. And Job, sadly, is now in front of us modeling it thousands of years ago, saying, maybe God doesn't exist for me. Maybe I exist for him. Maybe the hedge isn't meant to be broke down. maybe the issue is in my deception of how I view God, I have now seen the hand of God as some sort of restriction on my life. My friend, we'll only find ourselves in despair if we go down the path that Job went. Try to control him, despair. Try to push against his hand, despair. And all of it is busted and broken because our thinking about who God is messed up. Christian, you can change your view of God today. You can change it. You can get on your knees before a holy God and say, God, I am tired of trying to use you to get where I want to go. I am tired of trying to treat you like some insurance program where as long as I pay the dues, I'm set. God, I am tired of believing that somehow you have hemmed me in and kept me away from what is really important. God, you don't exist for me. I exist for you. And right here, right now, we can start fighting against the broken, simplistic view of Job and begin to see God for who he is.